He's in Boulder, Colorado to celebrate the 25th anniversary of KGNU Community Radio. Thanks so much for joining us, Noam Chomsky.
Really glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about this, the topic of collateral language. In recent years, the Pentagon and then the media have adopted this term collateral damage to describe the death of civilians. Talk about the role of language in shaping and forming people's understanding of events.
Well, it's it's as old as history. It has nothing much to do with language. I mean, language is the way we interact and communicate. So naturally, the means of communication and the conceptual background that's behind it, which is more important, are used to try to shape attitudes and opinions and induce conformity and subordination. This has been true forever, but it became an organized and very self-conscious industry, really in the last century. And not surprisingly, it was created in the more democratic societies. So the first coordinated propaganda ministry, called the Ministry of Information, was in Britain during the First World War. It had the task, as they put it, of controlling the mind of the world. And what they were particularly concerned with was the mind of America, and in more specifically, the mind of American intellectuals. They thought if they could convince American intellectuals of the nobility of the British war effort, then American intellectuals could succeed in driving the basically pacifist population of the United States, which didn't want to have anything to do with European wars, rightly, to drive them into a fit of fanaticism and hysteria, which would get them to join the war. And Britain needed U.S. backing. So Britain had its Ministry of Information aimed primarily at American opinion and opinion leaders, and the U.S. The Wilson administration reacted by setting up the first state propaganda agency here, called the Committee on Public Information. This is already Orwellian, of course. We don't have to even comment on what a Committee on Public Information is. But it succeeded. It succeeded brilliantly, in fact. Mainly with liberal American intellectuals, people of the John Dewey circle, who actually took pride in the fact that they were, for the first time in history, according to their picture, wartime fanaticism was created, not by military leaders and population and politicians, but by the more responsible, serious members of the community, namely thoughtful intellectuals. And they did organize a campaign of propaganda which within a few months did succeed in turning a relatively pacifist population into raving anti-German fanatics who wanted to destroy everything German. I mean, reached the point where the Boston Symphony Orchestra couldn't play Bach. You know, the country was driven into a hysteria. And it did enable Wilson to... Wilson had won the election on the slogan, Peace Without Victory. But within a couple of months, he turned the country into fanatics who wanted to win victory and destroy everything German and no peace. And that had an impact. The members of the committee of Wilson's propaganda agency included people like Edward Bernays, who became the guru of the public relations industry, and Walter Lippmann, the leading public intellectual of the 20th century, the most respected media figure. And they very explicitly drew from that experience. You look at their writings in the 1920s, they say, okay, we've learned from this that you can control the public mind. You can control attitudes and opinions. That's where Lippmann said, we can manufacture consent by the means of propaganda. Bernays said the more intelligent members of the community can drive the population into whatever they want by what he called engineering of consent. It's the essence of democracy, he said, both of them held. And it became it also led to the rise of the public relations industry. I mean, it sort of existed before that, but it was very impressed by this achievement. And that from that comes the enormous public relations industry, which was based on an interesting conception. It's interesting to look at their thinking back in the 20s when it really got started. This was the period of Taylorism in industry, when workers were being trained to become robots. Every motion controlled, you move to the left here, and so on and so forth. And that was extremely impressive. It created a highly efficient industry with human beings being turned into automata. Bolsheviks were very impressed with it, too. They tried to duplicate it. In fact, they tried throughout the world. But the thought control experts realized that you could not only have what was called on-job control, but also off-job control. It's their phrase. Off-job control means turn people into robots for the rest of their lives. So control them off-job by inducing a philosophy of futility, focusing people on the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption, and basically get them out of our hair. Let the people who are supposed to run the show do it without any interference from the mass of the population who have no business in the public arena. And from that comes enormous industries, ranging from advertising to universities, all committed to very consciously to the conception that you must control attitudes and opinions because the people are just too dangerous. Actually, they have good constitutional sources for that. The founding of the country was based on the principle, the Madisonian principle, that the people are just too dangerous. Power has to be in the hands of what Madison called the wealth of the nation, people who respect property and its rights and are willing to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority. The majority have to be fragmented somehow. But by the 1920s, this became highly self-conscious and major industries, and it's particularly striking that it developed in the more democratic societies. It was later duplicated. They tried to duplicate it in Germany and Bolshevik Russia and South Africa and elsewhere, but it was always quite explicitly on the mostly American model. And why in the democratic societies? Well, there's a good reason for that. If you can control people by force, it's not so important to control what they think and feel. But if you lose the capacity to control people by force, it becomes more necessary to control attitudes and opinions. It brings us right up to the present. By now it's not so much government agent. It was to some extent, like Reagan had what they called an office of public diplomacy. But by that time, the public was no longer willing to accept state propaganda agencies. So the Reagan Office of Public Diplomacy was declared illegal and had to go in roundabout ways. But instead of this, what took over instead was private tyrannies, basically, corporate systems, which play the role of controlling opinion and attitudes, not taking orders from the government, but closely linked to it, of course. And that's our contemporary system. Extremely self-conscious. I mean, you don't have to speculate much about what they're doing because they're kind enough to tell you, in industry publications and so on. Also in the academic literature. So you go back to, say, the 1930s, perhaps the founder of modern, good bit of modern political science, liberal progressive Wilsonian, Harold Lasswell, in 1933 wrote an article called Propaganda. People were used the term freely then, before the connotations that came from the Nazis. So it was just openly called propaganda. Now there are various euphemisms. He wrote an article called Propaganda in the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, a major publication, in which the message was that we should not, all of these are quotes, incidentally, we should not succumb to democratic dogmatisms about people being the best judges of their own interests. They're not. We are. And since people are too stupid and ignorant to understand their best interests, for their own benefit, because we're great humanitarians, we must marginalize and control them through, and the best means is propaganda. There's nothing negative about propaganda, he said. It's as neutral as a pump handle. You can use it for good or for evil. And since we're noble, wonderful people, we'll use it for good, to ensure that the stupid, ignorant masses remain marginalized and separated from any decision-making capacity. And that's in the hands of us, and we're but good by definition, so we'll do the best for everyone. And that includes world government, domestic control, and so on. This is not the right wing that I'm talking about. These are the liberal, progressive intellectuals. And in fact, the Leninist doctrines are approximately the same. They're very close similarities. The Nazis also picked it up. If you read Mein Kampf, Hitler was very impressed with Anglo-American propaganda. He argued, not without reason, that that's what won the First World War, and vowed that next time around the Germans would be ready too, and developed their own propaganda systems modeled on the democracies. The Russians tried it, but it was too crude to be effective. South Africa used it, others, right up to the present. But the real forefront is the United States, because it's the most free and democratic society, and it's just much more important to control attitudes and opinions.
A couple of quotes, actually, from Mein Kampf, from Hitler's book. The broad mass of a nation will more easily fall victim to a big lie than to a small one. Then he added, by shrewd and constant application of propaganda, heaven can be presented to the people as hell and vice versa, the wretchedest existence as a paradise. Can you make the leap from propaganda then and its origins to what's going on today with what is called Operation Iraqi Freedom?
You can read it in this morning's New York Times. This is, what's today? Saturday?
April 5th.
April 5th. Okay, this morning's New York Times, and the inside, there's an interesting article about Karl Rove, the president's manager, basically. His minder is what they call it in Iraq. When it teaches him what to say and do. He's the and it describes what he's doing now, Karl Rove. He's not directly involved in the war planning, but neither is Bush. I mean, this is in the hands of other people. But his goal, he says, is to present the president as a powerful wartime leader aimed at the next presidential election, so that the Republicans can push through their domestic agenda, which is what he concentrates on, which means tax cuts, they say, for the economy, but they mean for the rich. Tax cuts for the rich and other programs, which he doesn't bother enumerating, but which are designed, if you look at them, to benefit an extremely small sector of the ultra-wealthy and privileged, and will have the effect of harming the mass of the population. But more significant than that, it's not outlined in the article, is to try to destroy the institutional basis for social support systems. So try to eliminate things like schools and Social Security and anything that may be, that is based on the conception that people have to have some concern for one another. That's a horrible idea, which has to be driven out of people's minds. The idea that you should have sympathy and solidarity, you should care whether the disabled widow across the town is able to eat, that has to be driven out of people's minds. The best way to control, for off-job control, is to turn people into creatures who are focused solely on maximizing their own consumption and have no concern for anyone else. And the problem with things like, say, schools or Social Security or anything else, is that it's based on natural human emotions, that you do care about other people. And that must be driven from people's minds. That's a large part of the domestic agenda, quite apart from just shifting wealth and power even more than it is now towards narrow sectors. And the way to achieve that, since people aren't going to accept it, the way to achieve it, and it's stated explicitly, is to make people afraid. If people are frightened that their security is threatened, they'll gravitate towards the strong leaders, like Hitler. It says they'll trust the Republicans to protect them from enemies and therefore suppress their own concerns and interests. We'll be able to drive through the domestic agenda and maybe even institutionalize it, so it'll be very hard to reconstruct. But we have to do it by presenting the president as a powerful wartime leader, succeeding in overcoming this awesome foe, which, of course, is chosen because it barely exists and can be crushed in no time.
Iraq.
Iraq. And that's the... It's laid out pretty explicitly. I mean, not precisely in the words I just used, but the message is very clear.
Well,
so, yeah, that's what you do. And it's aimed at the next presidential election. That's a large part of this war.
Clearly, there's a huge gap on the Iraq war between U.S. public opinion and literally the rest of the world. Do you attribute that to propaganda?
There's just no question about it. You can trace it precisely. The campaign about Iraq took off last September. This is so obvious, it's even discussed in mainstream publications, like the chief political analyst for UPI, Martin Seif, has a long article just describing how it was done. I mean, it's transparent. In September, which happened to be the opening of the midterm congressional campaign, that's when the drumbeat of wartime propaganda began, and it had a couple of constant themes, just like Hitler. Few big lies. One big lie is that Iraq is an imminent threat to the security of the United States. We've got to stop them now or they're going to destroy us tomorrow. The second big lie is that Iraq was behind September 11th. Something nobody says it straight out, it's kind of insinuated. They were responsible. The next one is they're planning new such atrocities, and therefore we've got to stop them now or we're really in danger. Well, take a look at polls. They reflected the propaganda very directly. It's a government. The propaganda is distributed by the media. They don't make it up. They just distribute it. You attribute it to high government officials or whatever you like. But the campaign was reflected very quickly in the polls by September. And since then, roughly 60%, oscillating around that, of the population believes that Iraq is a threat to our security. Congress, if you look at the Declaration of October, when they authorized the president to use force, said Iraq is a threat to the security of the United States. By now, about half the population, maybe more by now, believes that Iraq was responsible for September 11th, that Iraqis were on the planes, that they're planning new ones. These attitudes are closely correlated to support for war. And it makes sense. I mean, if you believe that Iraq is an imminent threat to our security and was responsible for the September 11th atrocities and is planning new ones, then it makes sense to say, okay, let's go over where to stop them. Now, there is no one else in the world that believes any of this. There's no country where Iraq is regarded as a threat to their security. I mean, Kuwait and Iran, which were both invaded by Iraq, they don't regard Iraq as a threat to their security. It's ridiculous. I mean, Iraq's the weakest country in the region. And as a result of the sanctions, which have killed hundreds of thousands of people, about probably two-thirds of the population's on the edge of starvation, the country has the weakest economy and the weakest military force in the region. Its economy and its military force or expenditures are about a third those of Kuwait, which has 10% of its population, and well below others. And, of course, everybody in the region knows that there is a superpower there, offshore U.S. military base, Israel, which has hundreds of nuclear weapons and massive armed forces, and totally dominates anything. But Iraq is one of the weakest countries there. After the U.S. takes it over, it's very likely that it'll increase its military forces and maybe even develop weapons of mass destruction just to counterbalance other states of the region. It's very possible. So they're not afraid of it. They may hate Saddam Hussein. They're not afraid of him. And for the past 5 years, in fact, they've been trying hard to reintegrate Iraq back into their own system over strong U.S. objections, because the U.S. doesn't want that to happen. But only in the United States is there fear and or any of these beliefs. And they are, you can trace the growth of the beliefs to the propaganda. So after September 11th, the percentage of the population in polls that thought that Iraq was involved was, I think, 3%. By now it's probably over half, maybe 60%. These are real achievements in propaganda, not the first time. It's kind of like the First World War. It's pretty much what the Wilson administration succeeded in doing within a few months. And there are plenty of cases since. It's interesting that the United States is so susceptible to this. I mean, there is a background, a cultural background, which is interesting, but whatever the reasons are for it, the United States happens to be a very frightened country. By comparative standards, levels of fear here of almost everything, you know, crime, aliens, you pick it, are just off the spectrum. Now, you can argue, you can inquire into the reasons, but the background is there. And the people in Washington know it very well. It's kind of obscured, but should be right in front of everyone's attention. These are the people who ran the country from in the Reagan first Bush administration, almost the same people. And they managed, they're replaying the script. They pursued very regressive domestic programs which harmed the population and which were very unpopular, and they succeeded in staying in political power by pushing the panic button every year, and they're doing the same thing now. And it's again in the United States, it's not hard to do.
I'm interested that you usually define things with a tremendous amount of clarity and precision, yet you say conditionally that there is something in the American character that lends
the culture.
Itself. What is it that lends it, that
That's
makes it susceptible to propaganda?
I don't say it's more susceptible to propaganda. It's more susceptible to fear. It's a frightened country. And again, the reasons for this are, I don't frankly understand them, but they're there and they go way back. They go way back in American history.
But if the fear is there, then propaganda becomes relatively easy to
much
implement.
Much easier. Certain kinds of propaganda become much easier to implement. Frightening people is very easy. I mean, look, when my kids were in school 40 years ago, they literally were being taught to hide under desks to protect them from atomic bombs. I mean, you know, elsewhere in the world, this isn't even a joke. No. Actually, there's a comment that ought to be famous by a Mexican ambassador back at that time. Kennedy was trying to organize the hemisphere to support his terrorist attacks against Cuba, which were very severe. He had a major campaign of international terrorism going on against Cuba and economic warfare to try to strangle it. And he was trying to organize the hemisphere to back it. Well, the U.S. is very influential in the hemisphere. Countries just have to do what they're told or they're in bad trouble. But Mexico refused to go along. And the Mexican ambassador said, if I try to tell people in Mexico that Cuba is a threat to our security, 40 million Mexicans will die laughing. Well, you know, in the United States, people don't die laughing. People are afraid of everything. Take crime. It's not much different. In the United States, it's kind of like other industrial societies, kind of toward the high end, but not off the spectrum. Fear of crime is much higher in the United States than other countries. Even things like belief in aliens. You know, if you go to Europe and you ask people, are there aliens among you? They won't even know what you're talking about. Here, it's probably half the population.
But don't you think media culture contributes to that? All the TV shows, all the movies?
Probably. But there's a background of fear which is exploited. And it goes pretty far back. Exactly, it probably has to do with conquest of the continent, where you had to exterminate the native population, slavery, where you had to control a population that was regarded as dangerous, because you never knew when they were going to turn on you. It may just be a reflection of the enormous security. I mean, the security in the security of the United States is beyond anyone else. You know, the United States controls the hemisphere, it controls both oceans, it controls the opposite sides of both oceans, never been threatened. I mean, the last time the U.S. was threatened was the War of 1812. Since then, it just conquers others. And somehow this engenders a sense that somebody's going to come after us. So the country ends up being very frightened.
Bush gave his first primetime press conference on Thursday, March 6th, the first in a year and a half. And it was actually a pre-scripted press conference where people knew in advance who was going to be called on. So there was no spontaneity whatsoever. A study of the transcript reveals, again, a constant repetition of certain phrases. Iraq, Saddam Hussein, threat, increasing threat, deep threat, 9/11, terrorism, the Twin Towers, just repeated over and over again. On Monday, just a few days later, there was a sharp spike in public opinion polls in the United States showing that Americans believe by yep. large numbers now, majority, that Iraq was connected to 9/11.
Yeah, but this has been happening since September. You're right, these are very carefully programmed events. It's like television ads. You know, it's the public relations industry is a huge industry, plenty of experience in this. Everything is programmed. Reagan was carefully programmed. Everyone knew that if he got off his note cards, he had to quick shut him up because he was going to say something insane. But he was a media figure. This administration also has a collection of highly crafted media figures. George Bush is created to be the simple, honest, religious, straight-talking man who's got instincts, you know, deep morality, good and evil, kind of caricature of children's fairy tales and so on. All of that is very carefully crafted. Colin Powell is crafted to be the moderate multilateralist, committed to diplomacy and so on. There's not a particle of evidence for any of that. His record is horrendous. And that means that when he stands up and says, well, you know, we have to go to war, then that really shows that, you know, even no matter how far out you go, people agree. It's all very carefully done. And you're right about the spike, but the real change was September. That's when the poll results quickly indicate the fear, the belief in Iraqi participation. It has to keep being reinforced because otherwise it'll just drop off. The point is these claims are so outlandish that it's very hard to expect people to sustain them unless you keep driving it home. And that's what advertising is about. It's the same if you're trying to sell cars. Yeah, that's what you have to do. You have to, if you're trying to drive people to become mindless consumers whose lives are focused on maxing out their credit cards and working, having the highest workload in the industrial world so they don't interfere with you when you're running the world, you have to keep at them from infancy, and you have to do it here too. And it is indeed a major industry. The government is part of it. The media go along and participate in it. And it has effects. This is not the only time. Take a look at the 1988 political campaign. How did George Bush get elected? Well, Willie Horton. You know, they invented a... African-American criminal is going to come in you and rape your daughter. I mean, they didn't say it in those words, but it was constantly insinuated. And it did shift public attitudes. Actually, one of the most spectacular cases was September 1989. Through the 1980s, to maintain power, they had to maintain constant fear. One of them was the drug war. and the drug war, gets redeclared every few years. But a striking case was September 1989. I looked at that closely. Before the campaign, Bush started this, the Hispanic narco traffickers are going to destroy us line, started in September. Before that, concern about drugs was there, but it was low. It wasn't ranked high among concerns. By the end of the month, it was the top concern of the public. Massive publicity. Coverage of the threat of drugs was greater than coverage of all international affairs for the month. A lot of media hysteria. It was all a build-up to the invasion of Panama.
Which occurred in December.
In December. But it just changed concern of... the fear of drugs is another index of the difference between the United States and similar societies. Drug use is about the same here as anywhere else. But fear of drugs is off the spectrum. And it does get stimulated by government media campaigns. This one was particularly spectacular because it was so fast and effective. And they know that, especially the people in Washington right now. They know it. Now, there's a reason why Karl Rove is the most important person in the administration. He is the public relations expert in charge of crafting the images so you can drive through the domestic agendas, carry out the international policies by frightening people and creating the impression of a powerful leader is going to save you from imminent destruction. Actually, this morning's Times, they virtually say it. Because it's very hard to keep hidden. But it is second nature. It was, as you say, recognized by Hitler and the basis for Nazi propaganda, but using explicitly the Wilson administration as a model.
Well, how does one recognize propaganda, and what would be some techniques in terms of resisting it?
There's no techniques, just ordinary common sense. If you hear that Iraq is a threat to our existence, but Kuwait doesn't seem to regard it as a threat to its existence, and nobody else in the world does, any sane person will begin to ask, okay, where's the evidence? And as soon as you ask where's the evidence, it collapses instantly. But you have to be willing to develop... an attitude of critical examination of whatever's presented to you, and anything. This should be ordinary sanity. Of course, the whole educational system and the whole media system is, a lot of it is sort of driven by the demand to drive that out of your mind. So you're taught to be a passive, obedient follower. And unless you can break out of those habits, you're a victim of propaganda. But it's not that hard to break out. The same right through the 80s. In 1985, Reagan declared a national emergency in the United States because of the threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua, which was 2 days from Harlingen, Texas, was planning to take over the hemisphere. Take a look at that National Emergency Declaration of 1985, which was renewed annually as a way of building up support for the U.S. war in Nicaragua. It's almost the same wording as the Congressional Declaration of October 2002. Almost the same. Just replace Nicaragua by Iraq. Well, how much critical intelligence does it take to determine how much of a threat Nicaragua is to the existence of the United States? People outside just look at this in wonder and don't understand it. Right through the 1980s, the tourist industry in Europe collapsed every few years because Americans were so frightened by one of these spikes that you mentioned that they were afraid to go to Europe. Because they thought if you go to Europe, there'll be some Arab there who's going to try to kill you. Europeans don't know what to make of this. How can a country be so frightened of something that is completely non-existent that they're afraid to travel to Europe?
That's happening again right now.
Yeah, it's happening again. But if you ask how do you break out of this, well, just use your ordinary intelligence. There's no special techniques. Just, you know, be willing to examine what's presented to you with ordinary, common sense, skeptical intelligence. Read what's presented to you the same way you'd read Iraqi propaganda. You have to have techniques for deciding that the Minister of Information in Iraq isn't to be trusted. Well, you know, look at yourself the same way. If you're willing to look into the mirror, that's the major achievement that has to be made, is be willing to look into the mirror. You know, if you're willing to apply to yourself the same standards you apply to others, you've won. From then on, it's easy.
One of the new lexical constructions which I'd like you to comment on is embedded journalists.
That's an interesting one. I mean, it's interesting that journalists are willing to accept it. I mean, no honest journalist would be willing to describe himself or herself as embedded. To say I'm an embedded journalist means is to say I'm a government propagandist. But it's accepted. It helps implant the conception that anything we do is right and just. So therefore, if you're embedded in an American unit, you're objective. Actually, the same thing showed up in some ways even more dramatically in the Peter Arnett case. I mean, Peter Arnett is an experienced, respected journalist with a lot of achievements to his credit. He's hated here precisely for that reason. Same reason Robert Fisk is hated.
Fisk being British. Arnett originally from New Zealand.
Fisk is by far the most experienced and respected Middle East journalist. He's been there forever. He's done excellent work. He knows the region. He's a terrific reporter. He's despised here. You barely ever see a word of his. If he's mentioned, he's denounced somehow. The reason is he's just too independent. He won't be an embedded journalist. Peter Arnett is condemned because he gave an interview on Iraqi television. Is anybody condemned for giving an interview on U.S. television? No, that's wonderful. Now, if somebody is looking at this from the outside, so imagine some Martian who has the concept of independent journalism. Well, giving an interview on U.S. television is the same as giving one on Iraqi television. In fact, it's worse. It's not a symmetrical situation. The U.S. is invading Iraq. It's as open an act of aggression as there's been in modern history. It's not even concealed. It's just an open act of aggression, a major war crime. That's the major crime for which the Nazis were hanged at Nuremberg, the act of aggression. Everything else was secondary. Here's a clear and open example of it. No pretense of anything else. I mean, it's a pretense, but there's always a pretense. The pretenses are no more convincing than Hitler's. Actually, to claim that there's symmetry is already wrong, but let's put that aside. From an outside point of view, from an independent journalist giving an interview over the television of the invading forces and giving an interview over the television of the invaded country, shouldn't be any different. Here it's described as treachery, he's abandoned his journalistic integrity, and so on and so on. Well, what that demonstrates about U.S. journalism is astonishing. Actually, there's an article this week by one of the best American journalists, who's therefore one of the least used, Charles Glass, who's a Middle East correspondent with tremendous experience. He's now ABC correspondent in Iraq, except they almost never use him. He has an article in London, in the London Review, in which he points out that he says the United States must be the only country in the world where someone could be called a terrorist for defending his own country from attack. I mean, he's sitting there in Iraq and he's watching this with wonder. And in fact, anybody who's a little bit displaced from the United States and its system of indoctrination has to observe this with wonder. Actually, all over the world, it's creating enormous fear and hatred of the United States. This is everywhere.
We'll talk about that in a moment. The attack on Afghanistan in October of 2001 generated a couple of of these interesting terms, and you've commented on them. One is was the very operation itself, enduring freedom, and the other is unlawful combatant. Truly an innovation in international jurisprudence.
It's an innovation since the post-war period. After the Second World War, there was a relatively new framework of international law established, including the Geneva Conventions, and they do not permit any such concept as enemy combatant in the way it's used here. You can have prisoners of war. But there's no new category. I mean, actually, it's an old category, pre-World War II, when you were allowed to do just about anything. But under the Geneva Conventions, which were established to criminalize formally the crimes of the Nazis, this was changed. So prisoners of war are supposed to have special status and so on and so forth. The Bush administration is, with the cooperation of the media and the courts, is going back to the pre-World War II period when there was no serious framework of international law dealing with crimes against humanity and crimes of war, and is declaring the right not only to carry out aggressive war, but to classify people at bombs and captures as some new category who are entitled to no rights. In fact, they've gone well beyond that. The administration has now claimed the right to take people here, including American citizens, to place them in confinement indefinitely without access to families and lawyers, and to keep them there with no charges until the president decides that the war against terror, or whatever he wants to call it, is over. I mean, you know, that's unheard of. And it's been, to some extent, accepted by the courts. And they're, in fact, going beyond the new, what's sometimes called Patriot II Act, which is so far not ratified, but it was leaked. It's inside the Justice Department, but it was leaked. And by now there's a couple articles by law professors and others about it in the press. It's astonishing. They're claiming the right to remove citizenship, fundamental right. If the Attorney General infers, doesn't have to have any evidence, he just infers that the person is involved somehow in actions that might be harmful to the United States. I mean, you have to go back to the totalitarian states to find anything like this. Enemy combatant is one. The treatment of people and the idea of treating what's going on in Guantanamo is a gross violation of the most elementary principles of international humanitarian law since World War II. That is, since these crimes were formally criminalized in reaction to the Nazis. You look back at, say, Winston Churchill right in the middle of the war. He condemned the use of executive power to imprison people without charge as the most odious of crimes found only in Nazi and communist societies. Well, there's a bust of him looking at George Bush every day, but they might pay attention to his words, and Britain was in a little rather desperate straits at the time, not like the United States.
What do you make of British Prime Minister Tony Blair being quoted on Nightline on March 31st saying, "This is not an invasion, the attack on Iraq"?
Well, Tony Blair is a good propaganda agent for the United States. He's articulate. The sentences fall together. He's a nice... apparently people like the way he looks. He's following a position that Britain has taken self-consciously since the end of the Second World War. During the Second World War, Britain recognized, we have plenty of internal documents about it, they recognized what was obvious. Britain had been the world dominant power, and it was not going to be after the Second World War. The U.S. was going to be, and Britain had to make a choice. Is it going to be just another country, or is it going to be what they called a junior partner of the United States? Well, it accepted the role of junior partner. And that's what it's been since then. I mean, Britain has been kicked in the face over and over again in the most disgraceful way. And they sit there quietly and take it and say, okay, we'll be the junior partner. We will bring to what's called the coalition our experience of centuries of brutalizing and murdering foreign people. We're good at that. We've got centuries of experience in what Lloyd George called bombing the niggers. We know how to bomb the niggers. We've got centuries of experience in it. We're going to contribute that to the coalition. We'll be the junior partner. We'll get a couple of, you know, some privileges out of it. And that's the British role. It's disgraceful.
The British were bombing niggers in Iraq in the early 1920s.
That's where it came from. Yeah. Lloyd George was talking about bombing the niggers in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you look at the context, it's interesting.
Britain, we're using mustard gas, I believe.
That was Winston Churchill. He thought we ought to use poison gas. Bombing the niggers wasn't enough. He had to use poison gas, too. But Britain, which ran the region, did just what the U.S. is doing now. It undermined international conventions banning the use of air power against civilians, because that's what it was using in Iraq. Lloyd George's comment was, to quote it accurately, we have to reserve the right to bomb niggers. And what he was doing was applauding the British government for undermining an international convention against the use of aircraft against civilians, because we have to reserve the right to bomb niggers, and England has plenty of experience in that. And you know, real moral principles like that are lasting. They don't change. It's the same now.
Often at the talks you give, there's a constant question that's always asked, and that is, what should I do? This is what you hear in American audiences. We heard it last night in Denver on April 4th, for example.
You're right. It's American audiences. You never hear it in the third world.
Why not?
Because they, when you go to Turkey or Colombia or Brazil or somewhere else, they don't ask you, what should I do? They tell you what they're doing. Like you go to a landless work, and when I went to Porto Alegre, the first thing I went to was a campesino meeting.
Via campesina.
Via campesina at the landless workers' farm. They don't ask me what they should do. They were describing what they were doing. You know, these are poor, oppressed people living under horrendous conditions. They'd never dream of asking you what to do. They do it. It's only in highly privileged cultures that people ask, what should I do? We have every option open to us. None of the problems that are faced by people in, you know, intellectuals in Turkey or campesinos in Brazil or anything like this, we can do anything. But what people here are trained to believe is we have to have something we can do that'll be easy, that will work very fast, and then we can go back to our ordinary lives. And it doesn't work that way. You want to do something, you're going to have to be dedicated, committed, at it day after day. You know exactly what it is. It's educational programs, it's organizing, it's activism. That's the way things change. You want something that's going to be a magic key that'll enable you to go back to watching television tomorrow. It's not there. And it's true. This question is constantly asked in highly privileged sectors, nowhere else.
We're running out of time, unfortunately, but let's close with this particular question. I mean, you were an active and early dissident in the 1960s, opposing U.S. intervention in Indochina. You have now this perspective of what was going on then and what is going on now. Could you kind of tell listeners how dissent has evolved in the United States?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Actually, there's another article in the New York Times this morning, which gives an interesting perspective about it. It's describing how the professors are anti-war activists, but the students aren't. Not like it used to be when the students were anti-war activists. That's an interesting conception of the past. What the reporter is talking about is that around 1970, and it's true, by 1970, students were active anti-war protesters. But that's after 8 years of a U.S. war against South Vietnam, which had by then extended to all of Indochina, which had practically wiped the place out. In the early years of the war, it was announced in 1962, U.S. planes are bombing South Vietnam. Napalm was authorized, chemical warfare to destroy food crops, programs to drive millions of people into strategic hamlets, which are essentially concentration camps. All public, no protest, you know, impossible to get anybody to talk about it. For years, even in a place like Boston, a liberal city, you couldn't have public meetings against the war because they would be broken up by students with the support of the media. You have to have hundreds of state police around to allow the speakers, to, like me, to escape unscathed. You know, the protest came after years and years of war. By then, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. The country's been wiped out. Then you started getting protests. But all of that is wiped out of history because it tells too much of the truth. It involved years and years of hard work of plenty of people, mostly young, which finally ended up getting a protest movement. Now it's far beyond that. But the New York Times reporter can't understand that. I'm sure the reporter is being very honest. The reporter is saying exactly what I think she was taught, you know, that there was a huge anti-war movement and so on and so forth, because the actual history has to be wiped out of people's consciousness. You cannot learn that dedicated, committed effort can bring about significant changes of consciousness and understanding. That's a very dangerous thought to allow people to have, and therefore it's wiped out of history. And what you know about it, tail end after it was all done, and you say, well, how come it's not like that now, you know, after 8 years of war?
That was the voice of Noam Chomsky, MIT professor, political activist, and author. He's in Boulder to help celebrate the 25th anniversary of KGNU Community Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an award-winning weekly independent series featuring such voices as Howard Zinn, Rania Masri, Arundhati Roy, Edward Said, and Tariq Ali. Since its inception, AR has made a special effort to record and archive Professor Chomsky's work. To access our catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website is alternativeradio.org. To order CDs, cassettes, or transcripts of the program you just heard, Noam Chomsky on Collateral Language, just call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Thanks to Patrick Tillery for his tracking down a rare Bob Dylan recording, and to KGNU Community Radio in Boulder, Colorado, and to Free Speech TV, also in Boulder. Jeff Friesen is our producer. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. And we go out with Bob Dylan singing John Brown.
Well, she smiled and went right down. She looked up and all around, but she did not see her soldier's son in sight. But as all the people passed, she saw her son at last. When she did, she could hardly believe her eyes. His face was all shot up, and his hands were both blown off. He mean wore a middle brace around his waist. He whispered kind of slow in a voice she did not know. Well, she could not even recognize his face.